Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A recent New York Times story told of twin sisters who had to pay for their own college education. One chose the route of a private school while the other chose a public university looking for a good education at a good price. Guess who came out with more debt? The answer may be surprising, but the twin who attended the public university was more in debt than her sister. Why is this? How could it be? Later, we're going to talk to the president of Ohio State University's undergraduate student government, Micah Camras, about his take on the rising cost of tuition and affordability of attending college. Joining us now is Jane Wellman. Jane is the executive director of the Delta Project on Post-Secondary Education Costs, Productivity, and Accountability. Jane is widely recognized for her work in public policy and higher education at both the state and federal levels. Welcome to the show, Jane.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
To our listeners, go to deltacostproject.org. There's an interactive program that lets you crunch the numbers for yourself on just about any college or university that you can think of. See how much tuition has increased and how it compares to what the university actually spends to educate a student. And by the way, we invited participation in this conversation from anyone at the Ohio Board of Regents, including the chancellor. No one was available. Jane, in most states, it is now tuition payments, not state appropriations, that cover most of a student's, the cost of educating a student. When did this start to change?
Well, the trend lines in higher education have been going in the direction of less state funds and more tuition for the better part of the last 10 years, and a number of states crossed the line, if you will, between tuition as a majority of revenue as contrasted to state appropriations 8-10 years ago, Ohio being one of them. Ohio's per-student appropriations from state funds have historically been a little below national averages, and tuition revenues have been a little bit above national averages. I know it's been a priority for the state to turn those numbers around, but it's very tough to do in the current budget environment, which is bad in Ohio and bad in most states.
We're going to get to that later, but you know, the budget, they are $8 billion. There is that $8 billion projected shortfall this year. They have said they're going to eliminate the tuition cap in Ohio. Probably universities and colleges, public universities and colleges, will have to avail themselves of higher tuition rates. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you'd like to speak with Jane Wellman, executive director of Delta Cost Project. We're talking about the cost of a public education today and how the burden has switched from taxpayers to tuition payers. Community colleges are still mostly taxpayer-funded, though, right? There's a difference.
That's right, yeah. And I think Ohio, as is the case in other states, has tried to make sure that someplace in the state, and every student who needs it can get access to a low-cost education. And then those who want to go on to a baccalaureate or a graduate degree can transfer effectively from a community college into another type of institution. So a low tuition route into higher education is still available. It's more expensive than it used to be, and it's also harder to get into the community colleges because of there's an awful lot of demand for higher education, and many institutions, even though they are technically open access institutions, don't have the resources to provide classes to everybody. So college is getting more expensive, and it's getting harder to get into.
Yeah, you put it this way in that New York Times story. You said that the increasing dependence on tuition has disturbing implications for access to higher ed, that we're going to be rationing opportunity. We're moving in that direction fairly rapidly, you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we are. Mind you, Ann, I think it's not inevitable that rising tuitions means that college becomes both less affordable and less accessible. If tuitions are accompanied with good financial aid, then access to low-income students can be protected through the right combination of aid and tuition policies. I think the problem is that the environment we're in, these decisions are not being made in a strategic kind of way. They're being made in reaction to budget cuts. So tuitions go up, aid doesn't necessarily go up, and the institutions end up closing their doors. So I think it's the combination of the doors actually closing because there's not enough seats and higher tuition that is pushing more and more students out of higher ed.
Part of this could be that the cost of education has increased, couldn't it?
It could be, but in fact, the reality, if you look at the difference between price and cost, what institutions are spending per student has not gone up that much, and in many states it's flat or has even gone down a little bit. So we have had increasing efficiency in many institutions as they've accommodated more students without having the resources for it. Now, what's been happening is what we call cost shifting, which is that as state funds go down, the institutions swap out tuition revenue for state funds. So what they're spending hasn't changed. It's just the mix of revenue that's changed, and more of it's going on to the students.
Do your figures take into account capital expenditures? In other words, the money that the state gives public institutions that comes from its debt?
Unfortunately not. The data that would allow us to look at that in a way that would be comparable between different types of institutions really isn't in the public domain. So we're looking only at the operating side. We recognize that that's just a piece of it, probably somewhere around 75% or 80% of the total spending. So it's a pretty robust picture of what's going on economically in higher education, even though it doesn't include capital.
Is there a sense that public universities and colleges are doing their best, or is there overt evidence that they're trying to do more with less, to cut back, I hate to use the word cut corners, that's pejorative, but...
Well, no, I think it's any institution can improve efficiencies, and there's no doubt that in higher education, these are big, complicated institutions. They're decentralized. They have a lot of different sources of revenue, so they're sort of messy budgetarily. And no one would defend higher education as being a lean, mean educational efficiency machine. It's typically not all that efficient. I think it is the case. Having said that in most institutions around the country, college and university people take very seriously that they've got to do more with less. They have to step up to a responsibility to find efficiencies. They've been cutting, trying to find ways to cut as far away as possible from the academic program by looking at things like purchasing and construction contracting requirements and administrative structures and all those things where, you know, there's not a boatload of extra money lying around, but you can get a percent here and a percent there, and pretty soon you save 5%. And so I think they're doing that. They've got to do a lot more. They've got to do a lot more on the side of the academic program to make it more cost-effective for the students, make sure that more students get the classes they need when they need them, fewer repeated credits. There's no reason for students to have to repeat classes because credits don't transfer from an institution to another. And unfortunately, too much of that still can go on.
Particularly within a state system.
Exactly. I mean, but that's the tradition for a long time in Ohio and other states was that, you know, institutions didn't perceive themselves to be part of a system. And I think one of the good things that's happened in Ohio is that there's more of an identity of public institutions as sharing a common public mission in very different ways. I mean, that's still the institutions still have a great deal of independence, but under the Board of Regents, I think they're trying to do more to recognize they all serve the public need, and Ohio needs the higher education institutions to be working for the future of the state. If you don't have a high performing higher educational system, then we're not going to have the economy and the society we need 10, 20 years from now.
There's already a lot of push and pull between along the issue of tenure for professors and the costs that the money that is spent on administration at big universities and colleges. Does that play into it?
Sure. I mean, this is one of those things where there's truth on both sides of this, but you know, neither side has it exactly right. you look at the spending patterns in higher education in the last decade, and the spending for the direct cost of instruction, the amount of money that's going to pay for faculty, has not been going up relative to other spending areas. So you can't look at that and say, here's the smoking gun. It's all tenure. It is true within most institutions that the investment in tenure means that the institutions don't have a good deal of flexibility in how they manage their budget, so that if you have a tenured geography professor and nobody who's interested in geography, you can't take that tenured geography professor and put them in the physics classroom or the teacher ed classroom where maybe you actually have a greater need. So it does present some problems in terms of efficiencies for the universities. What they've been doing everywhere is increasing the number of faculty who are working on a part-time basis who don't have tenure. So, in fact, about half the teaching in most states, and I don't know the statistics for Ohio specifically, but I'd be surprised if it's very different, about half of the teaching is done by people who don't have tenure and who and don't, in fact, get paid benefits. So,
But research dollars are another factor in this equation, aren't they? And tenured professors tend to be those that bring in the research?
In some fields, that's true, but it's not true equally in all types of institutions, and it's not true equally in many disciplines. The social sciences and humanities have never had much of an extramurally funded research base. It's very true in the biomedical sciences, engineering. That's been a big part, and it's very important for Ohio's economy and for all states' economies.
In that same New York Times article, Scott Pattison of the National Association of State Budget Officers said that, quote, the difference between this downturn and others in the past is that this time I don't think higher education will be able to recover the ground it's lost.
Right.
I was wondering if you agree with that and then if there is a fix for this.
Unfortunately, I think it's true, and I think there's a fix, although it's not the fix we've had. In the past, we've always – higher education, if you look at state funding lines for higher education, they look like wiggly spaghetti. They go up, they go down, but the trend line has been down. And in the past, colleges and universities could count on budget cuts coming back in a couple of years. So if the state cut your budget in 1 year, you could generally get by with a bit of a tuition increase and a lot of short-term budget cuts, like hiring freezes, and across-the-board reductions of 1% or 2%, and that'd be enough to get you through it. This time, we don't think that the money's going to be coming back as fast or as much. We'll be lucky in most states to return to a kind of steady state pattern where if we're able to keep higher education funding pretty much flat, avoid further cuts, maybe if we're lucky, get a percent or two on the upside, we'll be doing very well. So what that means is that institutions have got to be doing more to live within those kinds of resource constraints.
I want to thank my guest, Jane Wellman. Jane is the executive director of the Delta Project on Post-Secondary Education Costs, Productivity, and Accountability. Thank you for joining us today, Jane.
I sure appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
We have a Facebook message from Carl. He says, what we'll be paying to send my boy to OSU is as much as I would have paid to attend Yale in the early 90s. I know that it was 20 years ago, but it still got my head spinning. Here's something else to spin your head, Carl. Back in 2002, typical undergrad paid $5,730 to attend Ohio State University. In 2008, that was $8,676. That represents a 51.4% increase. When we return, we'll be joined by Micah Camras. He is the OSU Student Government President. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. At 1 o'clock, On Point discusses first Tunisia, now Egypt, with riots, tear gas, and blood in the streets. On Point looks at what's unfolding in the Arab world. Join us for that discussion this afternoon at 1 o'clock. And it's currently 28 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today, a high of 32 degrees. And snow is moving into the area later today. Expect snow tonight. Around an inch of accumulation is possible and a low of 24. Cloudy skies for Friday and a high of 32. A chance of snow Friday night and a low of 26.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Kappa, presenting Le Ballet Trocadero de Monte Carlo, an all-male dance company performing playful parodies of traditional ballet, Friday the 28th at the Palace Theater. Details and tickets at kappa.com.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the cost of a public college or university education. I was talking with Jane Wellman before. She's from the Delta Project, and I mentioned some statistics from their report. If you want to learn more about that, you can go to the Delta Project. I'm sorry, DeltaCostProject.org. We'll post that on our website as well at WOSU.org/allsides. I mentioned Ohio State University, since between 2002 and 2008, has increased their tuition 51.4%. My alma mater, Michigan State University, increased it 40%. The biggest increase during that period of time in the Big Ten, University of Illinois, 56.8%. How much more can the state cut from its subsidy of public universities and still call them public? At Ohio State, 51% increase in that period of time. What do you think? There's been a tuition freeze on, but with gigantic state budgets looming, state budget deficits looming, that freeze will end this year. Joining us now is Micah Camras. He's president of undergraduate student government at Ohio State University. Welcome to the show, Micah.
Thanks for having me, and I really appreciate it.
You just gave your State of the University address this week. Did you talk about tuition?
We did, actually. I discussed that it's our number one priority for students and for our student government is keeping college affordable for all Ohio State students. The Ohio State University is such a great place for students to come because you get a top-notch education at an affordable price, and it's really critical that it stays that way.
Does it still feel affordable?
It's definitely becoming more expensive. Those statistics don't lie. I'd say it still is affordable if you look, comparatively across the country. Right now, Ohio State is, I think, one of the best bargains you can get in terms of the quality of education for your tuition dollars. And I'm hoping that it remains that way.
Now, I ran into a professor friend of mine walking the dog this morning, told him I was going to be talking about this, and he said, don't forget to mention textbooks. So this is tuition isn't the only thing that's increasing in cost.
That's certainly true. The cost of education is not just tuition, and we're really finding increases all across the board, and we're trying to find ways to help students cope with that because, every element of being a student is becoming increasingly more expensive.
So when you say you make it a top priority, what can you do?
Well, the first thing I think is it's important that we lobby the state government and let them know that it should be their top priority. I listened to our elected officials and our new governor talk about Ohio needs to be job-friendly and be a source of innovation for the country, and I think that begins with education and with higher education. The Ohio State University is the flagship institution of the state, and it's very important that it can continue to be affordable so that Ohio's brightest students will come here instead of leave the state.
My guest is Micah Camras. He's president of Ohio Student Government at OSU Student Government. If you have a question or comment for Micah, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. You can Twitter us at Ann Fisher WOSU. Micah, what are students saying about the challenges of paying for this?
I listen to students talk about how their financial aid is decreasing, tuition is increasing, they're working two jobs, which is making it harder for them to continue with their studies and to give school all the attention that it deserves. And, it's really difficult for students, and everyone's just trying their best. No one thinks that this should be, an easy process. College should be challenging, and that's how we learn. But we need to make sure that we're providing our state students with as much as they can to succeed.
What about athletic and academic scholarships? Don't they help a lot of students?
They do. Our athletic department is entirely self-sufficient in terms of their funding, so that's separate of state subsidy. But there is a lot of scholarship that the university gives. We try to keep access as a number one priority of the university and trying to find ways to make a college experience possible for someone who may not otherwise be able to afford it.
Have you talked to fellow students who say they may not be coming back next year?
I haven't heard a ton of that yet. You know, we don't really know what tuition is going to be looking like next year, which is you know, a little bit of a scary thought for us. But the governor hasn't proposed his new budget yet. He doesn't have to until March.
Right.
So we're anxiously awaiting that. We're trying to make sure that the governor will continue to fund higher education. We've actually partnered with student governments at other schools so that we've written about 5,000 letters to Governor Kasich asking him to keep it a priority. And he's an OSU alumni.
Has he written back?
We haven't received a response yet.
What about fees? I mentioned textbooks. Those are going up. Fees, those are going up?
We have had a few fee increases recently. We introduced an Ohio Union fee, actually, this past year to help pay for the cost of our brand-new student union. And you're right, with everything, instructional fees, we now have fees in some colleges at Ohio State for printing costs or different instructional fees. Our Fisher College of Businesses recently went up, so those are on the way up as well.
Bob from Akron, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. I'm from Akron, as you said, mm-hmm. and I've watched the University of Akron grow tremendously since I graduated in 79.
You mean physically grow, not student-wise.
That's right, and this is what I'm trying to bring a point across, is that they have physically grown. They've built humongous parking garages, dorms downtown, which aren't even filled. Why could not some of this stuff be done privately? When I went to school, and this is going to blow this young man's mind off, that a credit hour was $20 an hour. I don't know what it is now. But when I graduated, I didn't pay with books and everything and fees no more than $750 a year. I mean, I see every time we put money into capital improvements that the spending for a student, to go to school increases dramatically.
That comes from different pots of money, of course, capital improvements, and the capital improvement budget, the capital budget for the state will come out next year. They alternate the years, but they are from different pots of money, they always say, and it comes from, they go into debt to spend that money. It's not from the operating fund.
Why are we building a three-block garage in Akron when enrollment's down since I've been there?
Well,
it's been fluctuating.
You know, Micah, some students at OSU were complaining last year when the union went up. They're saying, hey, we can't afford this, that fabulous new union, and it is fabulous. But some believe that the university really couldn't afford it. Of course, the building money came from one place, but operating it still costs money. Micah?
Sure. Yeah, I've heard that from students, too. I think it's important to keep in mind that just because we're facing difficult economic times shouldn't prohibit the university from continuing to grow. I think what's made Ohio State really excel in the last few years is we've put together strategic plans to make ourselves more attractive to the top minds in the state and in the country and in the world. And part of that does include needing to have nicer facilities. Of course, there's going to be people upset with any new fee, but I think most students love the Ohio Union and love getting to be a part of it. A few years ago, we were introduced to a rec sports fee to help pay for our RPAC, our workout facility, which mm-hmm. is one of the best in the country. And I think that because of facilities like these, our admissions and our enrollment numbers have increased, and we've been getting better quality students. So I do understand saying, you know, maybe construction should be a little less, we should slow down during this difficult economic time. But I'm really proud of the university and of President Gee and his leadership team for helping us move forward despite the challenges.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to say thanks to Bob from Akron for his call. Jerome from Marysville, welcome to the show.
Hi. Bob from Akron sort of addressed the question I was going to ask, so I'm going to modify it a little bit.
Okay.
The guest brought up RPAC, and when I've been on the campus, you know, I look at that building and I say, my God, how many students are going to be able to afford a similar facility after they graduate? And the guest talked about, you know, comparable places overseas. I taught in Japan for 10 years. And, you know, the finest universities in Japan don't have the kind of facilities for students that we have here. You go to high schools and colleges, they have nothing like this, and they still manage to turn out competitive students. I mean, if to draw the best students, you need to have, you know, such a fabulous rec facility.
Why is that?
Students. What does that say about the best students you're recruiting?
That they're going for the workout spot, and not maybe who's the teacher in front of you in the classroom, Micah?
Okay, let's setting up false expectations that when they graduate, they'll be able to maintain that kind of fabulous lifestyle and a fabulous gym.
Okay. Thanks, Jerome.
I'd be hesitant to characterize it as that because college is really becoming way more than just an in-class academic experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think college is about learning to live as an adult. The thing that I've learned most is, you know, not being under my parents' supervision anymore, really just managing my life, and that includes doing my schoolwork, doing well in all of my courses. It also learns, you know, learning to be healthy, to eat on my own, to cook, to do my own laundry. All of those things are part of the growing up experience and the education experience. And, you know, I think it's very important that we have these nice facilities. I think it's, you know, it is an attractive thing for students, and it says that our students expect the best. And whether that's in the classroom and out of the classroom, I think that's really the Ohio State mentality, to expect the best and to do as well as we can. And also, actually, so you know, Ohio State students, when they graduate, if they choose to stay in Columbus, they can continue to be members of the RPAC if they just pay a fee. So they can continue to do that and enjoy the facility.
Thanks, Jerome from Marysville. I appreciate your call. Halsey from Westerville, welcome to the show.
Yes, hello. This is the first time I called since you switched from Fred Enderle.
Well, thank you for calling.
I don't have any problem with spending as long as it's for the benefit of the students. And as your guest talked about a union, it portrays a nice facility, attracts students and all that. So I'm all for it. But the problem I have is some of the spending that's really not justified. For example, during the campaign, we found out that the OSU gave Governor Kasich $1,000 an hour for some kind of an advice. And I think that's a total waste of money. And if Mr. Kasich now as a governor, I don't know how he will help OSU when he had the heart to charge $1,000 an hour. And I think he should return that money, really, to show that he's now concerned about the welfare of OSU. And I don't know if there is any other such kind of spending where they hire some consultants at $1,000 an hour. That is the problem. You can't have an increased tuition when you are willing to spend that kind of money for somebody. What kind of advice can he give you for $1,000?
Let's talk about that. Thank you, Halsey, for your call from Westerville. Micah, what about things like that the university spends money on? What are you shooting for when you look for efficiencies at Ohio State?
Sure. Well, President Gee recently announced that he wants to streamline all of our expenditures, making sure that we're doing everything as efficiently as possible. The example he likes to make is that we have thousands of pen vendors, and that can be done in just a couple. So I do think that the comment is correct, that there is probably some wasteful spending, and I'm glad that our university leadership is looking to cut down on that before we look to increase costs. And what the caller brought up about Governor Kasich taking money from Ohio State to be an instructor here, I know that arose a lot of controversy. I don't think he needs to give the money back, but I do hope that he understands how important Ohio State is from being a lecturer here, from being a student here. He was actually involved in our student government while he was here, and I hope that he will continue to keep in mind how important those experiences have been in his life when he makes the state budget coming up.
Okay, Halsey from Westerville, thanks for your call and thanks for listening. Mary from Columbus, you work at the Agricultural School at Ohio State?
Yes, the College of Agricultural.
Okay.
Agriculture, Food, and Environmental Sciences. I also actually work in the Department of Horticulture and Crop Science, which is under that umbrella. Anyway, I just wanted to speak real quickly to the availability of scholarships for OSU students. I mean, you know, there are three tiers of scholarships, you know, some at the university level, which are pretty much, you know, top scholar students, you know, very competitive. And then you have them in the different colleges, like, for example, in the College of Ag. You know, we have, that increases every year. We have about $1.5 million worth of scholarships that are available and given to, a small population of students. In the College of Ag, that, you know, maybe about 2,000 students. That's a pretty darn good, you know, bit of assistance there for those students. And then the other thing is, in our department alone, the horticulture department, we have about 100,000 dollars worth, and you know that's a couple 300 students.
I'd take it.
That's pretty good. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and they don't always have to be, you know, the very very top, you know, academically performing students. There are various ways that you can get scholarships. So, you know, I just wanted to put that out there because mm-hmm. there, I realize, yes, we do face that issue of the, you know, the increasing tuition and fees, but there also is a lot of help out there.
Micah, thank you very much, Mary, for your call. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Micah, how much do students, do you think, understand that how to tap into those sources? I know that when I, you know, when I went away to college, those many years ago, I really didn't think about tapping different kinds of sources for money. I just went the usual route.
Right. Well, I think our students are trying to be more creative now about ways to make college more affordable. So I think that is a priority of people. And the caller was right. There are so many students that I talked to that chose Ohio State over other schools because they received a lot of scholarship. But it's important to keep in mind that while there are so many opportunities out there, which we're thankful for, we're also losing a lot of opportunities. So, for example, the one that I'm most upset about is the Chancellor of the Board of Regents recently put forth his budget proposal for next year.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, it eliminated the Ohio College Opportunity Grant, OCOG, for public schools, which has been critical. It goes to any Ohio high school student who goes to an Ohio university if their parents have a combined income of under $75,000.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little under $1,000 a year that they receive. And it's looking like that's going to disappear for
next
year.
How much did that amount to? Do you know?
How much did what amount?
The OCOG, that line item in their budget, do you know?
I'm not sure for the whole state how much it costs. About 14% of Ohio State students receive it.
Okay.
So for those students, it's, you know, it's an almost 10% tuition increase just by losing that aid for next year, if that's the case.
Let me ask you, they're planning on compulsory on-campus housing for 2 years for OSU students. And I don't know if I read a letter to the editor or something from an OSU student who's complaining about why should he have to pay top dollar to live in a dormitory room when he could, you know, manage things and find efficiencies in his own lifestyle to live for much cheaper.
Right. I've heard that being discussed. And to be perfectly honest, I haven't heard a ton of movement in the program recently of where we are in the two-year living requirement. I know it's being worked on, but I haven't seen any proposals yet from the university leadership. I do understand the desire of students to want to have a more affordable second-year experience off campus. So what I've been pushing university leadership is that if we are going to have this change and that is something they want to institute, that they find a way to make it as affordable as living off campus.
Okay. Time for one more call before we take a break and move on. Mickey from Xenia, you're on the air. We just have about a minute left.
Okay. One of the things I've seen is the fact that the tuition isn't the problem. The problem is wages.
You mean what you earn when you get out of college?
Well, no. Minimum wage has not gone up. And most of the kids that are going to school are on minimum wage,
mm-hmm.
right? So it hasn't kept up with the cost of cars or tuition or anything. When I started college in 71.
Mm-hmm.
Minimum wage was $2.85.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a private school. Room, board, tuition, everything is $2,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
That same school is $32,000 a year. Minimum wage is, well, you know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that's been the real problem, is that wages have gotten static or have actually gone down.
Or it really in relationship to the cost of college.
Thanks
a lot for your
yeah,
call, Mickey. From Xenia. So Micah Camras, president of Ohio OSU Student Government, even if students do work two jobs, it's still not keeping up.
Right, and another thing to keep in mind is that it's very difficult for us to find paying jobs even at a minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
I know lots of students that are in internships that they hope will lead to a job down the road, but they're not making minimum wage. They're working for free just to try to learn more. So wages are important, but I disagree with the caller. I think tuition cost is the thing students care most about.
All right. Well, I want to thank you, Micah Camras, president of OSU Student Government, for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
When we return, we're going to talk about two more OSU students, this time about the homeless population in Columbus. They've been volunteering to do a census. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 MP. PR News. There are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or find WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our daily news loop e-newsletter at wosu.org/email.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes, beginning at 11, we'll have an open forum on All Sides. So stay with us for hour two of the program. And be sure to watch Columbus on the Record Friday night at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. This week, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson and his panel discuss the growing concerns about privatizing Ohio's Department of Development, potential cuts to Medicaid, and casino developers may truck sewage to Marysville. All that and more on Columbus on the Record tomorrow night at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. 28 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today and a high of 32 degrees, snow moving into the area later today. Expect snow tonight, about an inch of accumulation and a low of 24 degrees. Cloudy skies for Friday and a high of 32, and cloudy skies for Friday night, a chance of a little snow, a low of 26 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Well, by now you've probably heard of Ted Williams, the man with the golden voice who skyrocketed to fame a few weeks ago. He did leave behind a few friends on the streets of Columbus. Joining us today are two students from OSU's College of Social Work who volunteered to count the homeless on Tuesday as part of the Department of Housing and Urban Development's point-in-time count. Graduate student David Simmons is doing his field placement internship at the Faith Mission Men's Homeless Shelter. He's also employed there part-time as a file auditor of case files. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you very much, Anne.
Also with us, Tiffany Hart. She's doing her field placement internship at Faith Mission as well and has a specific interest in veterans, particularly homeless veterans. Tiffany, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Why do we need this special count? What is it used for, David?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, it is a Department of Housing and Urban Development nationwide element to assess the number that are homelessness. I personally volunteered because I feel that this count raises awareness of that issue, and it provides a focus for community concerns about homelessness.
What does HUD use it for?
HUD aggregates the information that they receive from communities all over the nation to have a benchmark number, and they realize that that is not, does not represent.
It's not exact.
It's not exact, but they use that as a metric to get a feel for the how imminent the issue is mm-hmm. and how expansive the issue is, and they do this at the same time every year so that they have a consistent result over the years.
My guest, David Simmons, he's doing his field placement internship at Faith Mission. He was part of the volunteer corps that counted the homeless on Tuesday as part of the Department of Housing and Urban Development's point-in-time count. If you have a question for David or his fellow volunteer, Tiffany Hart, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page. All Sides with Ann Fisher is on Facebook. So locally, Tiffany, they use the information. How do they use it locally?
The information affects the funding that we get to help support the population.
And you're talking about things like homeless shelters and food pantries, that sort of a thing?
Yeah. The money goes through to the community shelter board, and then they disperse it to the different organizations that need the money.
Does Faith Mission, for example, is this something that they pay attention to as a specific organization?
Definitely, I think so.
Yes. Actually, Faith Mission is more like the first responder for the issue of homelessness because they have the largest adult homeless community shelter. They are the central point of access for those that are homeless to access services. So they very much are concerned about this. And this time of the year with the plummeting temperatures, they experience a phenomenal increase in their population.
You know, I've already blocked it out, but I think Tuesday was one of those still pretty frigid days. What was it like to go out and do this, Tiffany?
It was one of the most amazing experiences I've ever had.
Tell us what time you started, how long you were out there, that kind of thing.
We went out about 4 a.m. We got there about 3 a.m. And we walked the Scioto River down by the Kosai and things like that. And we went under bridges and stuff through the snow to try to find people.
Why start so early in the morning?
Because that's when people are out there. That's when we can find them and know that that's what they're, if they're out there sleeping, then that's what the time they're probably going to be there.
Are most people in shelters, though, particularly in the winter?
Well, I think particularly with the frigid temperatures that we had last weekend,
yeah,
many did try to access shelter. In fact, when the temperatures go below 25 degrees, Faith Mission opens its doors and turns away no one. So we didn't find... Tiffany and I were on the same team. We didn't find anyone down by the river, and they may have access shelter. But the shelter board also has a meal count at the different community kitchens that are mm-hmm. offered to ask people, where did you spend the night last night, so that they get a complete number.
How many volunteers fanned out, and were you just limited to Columbus? Was that where you were looking?
There's probably about 100 people who showed up to go out and count. And, yeah, they sectioned off certain areas of Columbus, and that's where your group went to count.
And when you do that, do you get the names of the people you're counting? Do you get any kind of way to identify, and I guess to make sure you're not double counting?
Well, because of privacy concerns,
right.
What we do is offer them transportation to shelter and offer them the opportunity for a warm meal if they choose to. And that is one of the things that extends one of the ethical values of social work, which is the dignity and worth of the individual and their right to self-determination.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about the homeless population in Columbus. There was a census taken Tuesday in Columbus, actually around the country, and it's for the point-in-time count that's called for by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. If you have a question for our guests, they were both volunteers that day, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why can't the shelters just count for us maybe over a period of time instead of doing it all in one day like this?
Tiffany? Well, I think the shelters, when people have an option to come to the shelter, and if they choose not to come to the shelter, they're sleeping somewhere else. So by us going out and finding these people, then we're able to see the people who don't ever come into the shelters, and it gives us an opportunity to reach out to them.
Let's talk about the numbers. How many did you count? What do we know since Tuesday about Columbus? David?
Well, I don't believe they have the total number yet. Last year it was about 130. The year before that it was about 114. But it takes time. As I mentioned earlier, the community kitchens where they also have surveys, and they need to make certain that those that were on the land that were counted by the teams that Tiffany and I went out with
mm-hmm.
are not duplicated
right.
by those who access the other services available.
But otherwise, we know from last year how many homeless were living in Columbus.
Yes.
The
130. Those were the ones that were identified.
Okay.
Certainly there are far more that may inhabit abandoned buildings, which because, for safety concerns, we don't go into those
okay.
buildings, abandoned cars, and certain other areas that just because of the danger it poses at that time of the day.
Now, a growing demographic in the homeless population are families and children.
Yes.
Is that something that you encounter on the street, or do you find that they tend to find shelter?
We didn't run across that at all, but I did hear some groups talking about that when they came back.
Actually found people, like, in cars and things like that, or?
Yeah, they make tents and things under bridges and stuff.
Did you meet anybody special? Anyone that sticks with you? Tiffany?
I didn't meet any people that we found particularly, but I think the group members that we went out with, they're some pretty cool people, pretty amazing people to go out at that time of the morning to look for people sleeping out on the streets and things.
Well, why did you decide to do it?
I think it's it gave me an opportunity to reach out to people that I possibly don't see at my internship, and it just seemed like a great opportunity to go out there.
What'd you learn that you didn't know before?
That people are brave to be able to sleep out in those conditions. They're definitely brave people.
David, what about you? Why'd you do it? Did you get extra credit?
No. Okay. No, it often we stay up late and get up early to study for exams. But I think that human rights activities like this that promote social justice are one of the real tests. It's the true examination for what we've learned and to make that tangible into something that we experience.
You both work at Faith Mission. How are things there right now? Particularly, it seems like I do a lot more shows all the time about the economic downturn and how people are coping. What's it like there now?
It's very busy.
Yeah.
Case management load is overwhelming this time of the year. You begin to see that as the temperatures drop in October, and it will continue through mid, latter part of April. But we've seen, I've worked there for a couple of years now, and we've seen that increase progress over that period of time because of the recession.
I've got a Columbus High School sophomore coming on in the next hour to talk about a program he's developed for homeless veterans and to find housing for homeless veterans. Tiffany, a lot of veterans participate at Faith Mission?
We do have a lot of veterans there. They also go to other shelters like the VOA, and there are outreach workers.
Volunteers of America.
Yeah, and there are outreach workers with the VA that reach out specifically to the homeless veterans.
Any particular concerns that they have that and needs that they have that can be addressed at the shelters?
One of the things, shelters, even nationwide, largely have emerged as a hybrid response to the local perceived needs. At Faith Mission, they try to emphasize a holistic approach, and they have a medical, dental, optometry clinic. They also have an open kitchen where anyone from the community can come in for a warm meal every day.
So it's more than – and it's also a place where they get referrals to other agencies and other places.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We still have a few minutes with my guests, Tiffany Hart and Dave Simmons. They're both social work students at Ohio State University. David is a graduate student, and Tiffany is an undergrad. They volunteered for the Department of Housing and Urban Development's point-in-time count on Tuesday. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Amy from Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I work with a group up in Delaware called Family Promise, where we host families, homeless families, in our churches. But we've seen a lot of single men in the area, and the Family Promise program doesn't accept those individuals. Is there anything in the Delaware County area that we could refer them to, or is there a way that that transport is arranged for those types of individuals to a place like Faith?
David, do you know anything?
I may know something. I know that the Salvation Army, their homeless reach extends into Delaware County, and okay, may suggest that you call there, because I do know that they're very active in the homeless issue.
Yeah, we have two individuals in particular that we open up when we have our meals for the families. We open up our doors so that they come in and they have meals, at the church, but then we can't offer them lodging, which is sad.
Yeah.
Especially this time of year. So I was wondering if there was a place to refer to. So I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Well, Amy, thanks for everything you do to help the homeless in Delaware.
Oh, thank you.
Take care. Evelyn from Columbus, we just have about a minute left.
Oh, I was concerned about the people that are on the corners always holding signs. Are these the same homeless people, or is this another group of people? Because they're there every day, and it's like they take shifts standing on this corner. And you know you want to help, but every day?
Well, thanks for your call, Evelyn. David, we just have a minute or so. Tiffany, what do you think about that? Are those the people that you're talking about, some of them?
Well, I'm sure that's a small part of the population, but I think what it does is emphasizes the magnitude of the problem and the needs that people have.
That if you're just homeless one day, you're probably going to be homeless and looking for help the next day, too.
Yeah, and it could be anybody. It doesn't matter if you may be down on your luck or you may be out of a job. Anybody can end up in that situation.
In your work, David, at Faith Mission, anybody, you know, everyone's talking about Ted Williams now. Are there very many Ted Williams out there, period, but across the board. But you have to have met a lot of talented people over the years.
I have. There are many talented people that have, as Tiffany mentioned, they've fallen on a hard time for whatever reason. And there are significant barriers to reintegration with mainstream society. And that's what Faith Mission attempts to help people do.
Tiffany, same for you. You've met some pretty
special
people. Yeah,
I've met some pretty amazing people interning there. A lot of people who have degrees, college degrees, and they're down on their luck and out of a job, and they end up with us at Faith Mission. And we just try to help them get back on their feet.
Well, I want to thank you both for doing that and for joining us today. David Simmons, he's doing his field placement internship at the Faith Mission's Men's Homeless Shelter. He's also employed there part-time as a file auditor of case files. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And also Tiffany Hart, she's doing her field placement internship as an undergrad at OSU at Faith Mission and has a specific interest in veterans, particularly homeless veterans. Tiffany, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.